welcome to the Graphic Novel of the Month Club, the adult edition for the month of July. I am really, really happy about this book and our guest. The book is The Secret of Superhuman Strength, and our guest is the amazing Alison Bechdel, who is right there. Hi, Alison. How are you this evening?
Hello. I am tip-top, Brian. How are you?
I'm good. I'm feeling good. Thank you. I'm really excited to talk about the book. I'm excited to talk about your career. Let's get right into it. Let's go straight for it. My first question is always this: why comics? So to me, you're a superb writer. You're a good writer. And so, like, I'll even narrow it for you. Like, why do all the extra work of doing the comics? Do you know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. Yes, that's an excellent question.
Thank you.
And for me, I think, I don't know, I've always just had a very mystical attraction to the way that my drawings looked with words added to them. Letters and numbers combined with drawings equals some kind of magic for me. Just there's something pleasing about it. And I have a sort of fancy highfalutin theory for why I chose comics. Well, I have several highfalutin theories. One is that, I grew up in a family where everything was about appearance, but yeah, Things weren't what they actually appeared to be. There was always something else going on. So I learned to not quite trust appearance, and I learned to not quite trust language. Language always seemed very slippery and vague. And so comics is a way of almost kind of combining the strengths of language and the strengths of images to get a little closer to being able to say something true about reality.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That makes a lot of sense. And given what we've read your background, that answer makes a lot of sense to me. You're the first guest that we've had. This is like we're close to our 150th show, something like that. You're the first guest that we've had who came out of, you know, sort of the alternative newspaper cartoon strip tradition, and I'm really, really fascinated about that sort of whole period in the world where, you know, because for decades, right, you know, traditional newspapers were all that face to the public. And then kind of in the, you know, late 60s, but mostly the 70s and the 80s, alternative newspapers sprung up in every major city. And they had cartoons, but not the cartoons that you got in the regular newspaper. It wasn't, you know, High and Lois and Calvin and Hobbes. It was, you know, it was Dykes to Watch Out For, and it was This Modern World, and things that were a little askew. So can you kind of sort of talk us about the roots of those days? Because you're there at the beginning.
Yeah, well, I need to correct that story a little bit.
Please, correct anything that I say wrong.
Wait, I'm having this weird experience of whenever I talk, I fill the screen. Is that just the way the StreamYard works?
It doesn't have to. We'll put you in a two-shot here.
Yeah, because it's...
There you go. Oh, yeah, no problem.
Oh, God, it's
not
just
a problem.
Like I'm looking at this.
Yeah, no, it's all good. It's all good.
Whew. So I ended up getting into a few alternative weeklies, but I was like alt weekly. I was too like marginal for even the alt weeklies to consider. I think it was 1997 before I made it into a real alt weekly. And I started syndicating my work in like 1984, I think.
Okay.
So that's like over a decade of like toiling in the invisible gay and lesbian subculture margins.
Yeah.
Like it was a very, the stuff I was doing, which looks pretty tame and harmless now, this little lesbian soap opera, was just, it was unthinkable that that would run in the Village Voice in the 1980s. It was just too out there, too marginal. And, you know, so it was a real struggle for me. Well, it wasn't a struggle. I was quite resigned to that. It was like, that's just reality. Yeah. Fortunately, I have this amazing subculture with its own growing, you know, bunch of newspapers. All the cities with all weekly papers also started having gay and lesbian newspapers in the 80s and 90s. And that became how I earned my living, actually, just like going from paper to paper and peddling my comic strip to them, which is very much how the alt weeklies worked too, but they were reaching out a larger audience than I was.
Yeah. Yeah. So, when you started the strip in 83, is that right? 83? Do I have the date?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. That was when, But so I was just doing it for one newspaper at that point. It took me like a year or two to start circulating it around.
Yeah. And it was on you as the cartoonist to go and sell your work. There wasn't a syndicate, obviously, of any kind. Yeah.
No. And that was true for the alt weekly people too. I think they were all doing that same thing, except Matt Groening had some nice lady who did it for him.
Right. Yeah. How did you know about the sources, like the newspapers in other cities? Obviously, you know what's local, but
God, you know,
this is pre-internet, right? There's not bulletin boards to go in. There's not a Facebook group to check in.
Totally pre-internet. There would be things like, I mean, it's at a certain point down the road, there was a guide that this network of newspapers published, and they'd sell that, you know, and it would be worth investing, you know, $20 in this book every year. But before the guide came out, it was just hearsay. You know, if I traveled to another city, I would get their newspaper. I would go to their gay bookstore or their women's bookstore if they had it.
Yeah.
Another way that I made money when I was starting out was selling postcards of my cartoons to gay and women's bookstores. It seems so implausible now, like selling postcards. My God, how much money can you make doing that? But I didn't need that much money back then. And it helped. It was very useful selling all that stuff. I had a whole little side business of selling t-shirts and crap.
Yeah. How long did that last?
That lasted a long time. Till about 1997 or 8, I think I finally threw in the towel on that.
Okay. Was it just labor intensive? Was the problem at that point, or?
It was a lot of work, and it just started to not be making enough money for that work to be worth it. It was for a while, but you know, the formula just kept shifting a little bit. I started being able to earn more money from the actual comics. So that made
absolutely.
It less, you know,
yeah.
Who wanted to spend their time making a catalog and answering the phone to sell t-shirts. Like I was very happy to be done with that at last.
Right. Yeah. Now my understanding is that the first paper that you were in was also a paper that you worked in. You worked in the pay step department. Do I have that right? Or did I?
It was hardly a department. It was a volunteer newspaper that, you know, a band of volunteers put out. It was a monthly feminist newspaper in New York City, with great articles and a big calendar of events. Like that was one way pre-internet people stayed in touch, was there were these, you know, very up to the minute calendars. And so everyone wanted the paper.
Right. Yeah, no, and I mean, I remember like around the Bay Guardian and the Bay Area Reporter, you know, they would distribute them here. They would, you know, have the copies here. The guys would come and drop off the bundles, and we'd be very happy to give them away for free. But it was all very community-based, you know.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, very, very, very different than today. Do you remember what was your first expansion city?
I believe it was Philadelphia.
Okay.
Philadelphia Gay News was the first. I mean, the newspaper where I was working and publishing the comics, they didn't pay me. It was volunteer for the contributors too. So Philadelphia Gay News, I think, was the first paycheck I ever got for my comic strip.
Wow. And so like about a year after you had started, is that right?
A year, within 2 years, certainly. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. And it looked to me, I mean, I used to have all the original books, but you know, nowadays we only have the big essentials as sort of what's left. So it looks to me like it really was a couple of years, like I think 87. So like 4 years after you started the strip, before you started going to the format where it was about Mo and all of her friends.
So for a couple of years at the beginning, it was really just single panel cartoons with captions, like New Yorker type things that I did paper. I did that for at least a year, actually.
Okay.
And I found that those were getting really difficult to come up with, like to something that was punchy enough to stand on its own was hard, but I didn't feel ready to move to a strip because I didn't know how people drew the same characters over and over again so perfectly. So I did start drawing strips, but I would kind of make up new characters for each one.
Yeah.
For a while. And I did that for like a year and a half maybe. And it was 1987 when I first started writing about regular characters.
Yeah.
And I'm always just evolving for ease of writing. Like I found those one-off strips really hard to do after a while because I had to keep coming up with new scenarios. But with a regular, with regular characters, it was like I'd just get a story in motion and it was much easier to start writing the next episode because I already had, you know, a story in place.
Sure. And at a certain point, I assume, maybe I'm wrong, but the characters start writing themselves to a degree?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
It took a while.
Yeah. So when you started with the regular cast, how many papers were you in at that point, would you say?
In 1987, that's a good question.
Roughly, I'm not.
Probably 20, I would guess. Maybe two dozen. And at that point, I was not quite making a living. I still had a part-time job, and I made the other half of my living from the comics.
Yeah.
So yeah, probably 20 newspapers.
Yeah, and so like back in the day, like that. I mean, what were papers paying? Like $15, $20, $10. Okay. 15, yeah. 20,
yeah. Or yeah. Or nothing.
Right. Right. Okay.
Paid nothing.
Yeah. Yeah.
But so it would add up, you know.
No, it does. I mean, absolutely. I mean, I guess I wonder where, because at those days, again, pre-internet, you had to mail the strips physically out to each paper, right?
And yep.
So, like, after postage, was it even a minimum wage job? I guess
I never liked to count, but I know it took me a really long time to ever break the $20,000 a year income mark.
Yeah. How did you sort of at the peak of your audience, how many papers were you in, would you say?
You know, I used to say the number 50, but I don't think it was ever really 50 all at once because they were constantly folding and new ones starting.
Sure.
But certainly 40, you know. Yeah, it was a big operation.
Was it almost a full-time job just sort of keeping up on the back end of it those days?
I hired friends to do that for me because I just couldn't bear it. It was too demoralizing to keep track of how much money people owed me. And I had someone else like do that billing part for me. I kept, I kept tabs on it, but not in that
I imagine
way.
You had to chase people too.
God. Yeah, it was awful.
Yeah.
I would try to just only deal with that every couple of months.
Yeah. No, I understand. I wonder just because I you know I'm a little younger than you. Sort of what the scene was in terms of the split between women oriented places and gay and lesbian. Because at least in San Francisco, my impression was that the gay alternative press was the gay alternative press, and then there was the much, 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 much smaller lesbian alternative press, and never the twain shall meet, right? Like there was like almost a hostility between the gays and the lesbians, which I always thought was very strange.
I think that might have been the case in some larger cities, but I was in the Midwest. I was in the Twin Cities at the time that I started doing the regular characters. And we had like several gay papers. And ours was called Equal Time because it was very intentionally for both men and women. That was like our shtick. And, you know, it's hard to say anything general about all of that, you know.
Oh, sure.
For us, it was really exciting to work together, and we were always getting angry letters from lesbians who felt like we weren't giving them enough attention, and gay men who didn't want to read the lesbian articles.
Right, right.
We always felt like we were succeeding at what we were doing.
Yeah.
But there was a rift in terms of business model. Like, certainly the gay papers, the gay men focused papers had a lot more resources, and many of the papers that were women only, like just for lesbians, they didn't have any money, you know. Yeah. And those were the papers I'd give it away to.
Yeah.
Always just trying to calibrate all of that.
Yeah, my impression from the distance was always that it had to do more with advertising than anything else.
Especially as AIDS started to happen, and there was both this big rush of phone sex ads,
right,
and then all the pharmaceutical ads that really supported so much gay publishing for a long time in the 90s.
Yeah, yeah, it's got to be fascinating for you that how much culture has changed since then.
It is, and you know, I'm really glad that you're asking these questions, because I think, like, by tomorrow I won't even remember this stuff. I'm already forgetting what it used to be like.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it fascinates me, especially, I mean, being here in San Francisco. I mean, and I'm a straight man, but I mean, I could see all of the things that were going on in the city, and how the culture moved from being a subculture, even in San Francisco, which is known for that, to really being culture, you know? It's fascinating to me. And I kind of love the fact that, you know, nowadays in San Francisco, right, like on our mountainside, you know, there's a giant, like, glowing 40-foot high pink triangle during Pride with, like, lights beaming across the city, you know, like, it's hard to imagine that 25 years ago, at even a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah. I don't even understand queer culture anymore. Like, you can buy lesbian Avengers t-shirts at Target and rainbow shit anywhere. It's crazy.
Yeah. This year, the comics industry went all in on variant covers, right? So, like, periodical comics often have multiple covers on them. And so for June, everybody was putting out their Pride comics, you know. Nothing didn't change on the inside of the content, but there was a cover that had some rainbow flags on it so that everybody's supposed to buy it, I guess.
Yeah. What are you going to do?
It's better than the alternative, right?
It is absolutely better than the alternative.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want to go back to the bad old days.
Yeah, absolutely. You said that the original newspaper that you worked for was a monthly.
Yes.
And in the manuscript, it said that you're producing the strip bi-weekly, every other week. Did production increase? Were more places? I guess I'm trying to figure out how to square that particular circle.
Yeah. Well, that first paper was a monthly, and then as I started syndicating, these new papers, like the Philadelphia Gay News, were biweekly. That was kind of the model for these gay papers. They were biweekly, and they were a tabloid format. And so that's how the size and shape of my strip evolved. It was to fit along the bottom of one of those pages, or it could be stacked vertically, depending on the format.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But biweekly was the frequency that they all published at.
Yeah, because most of the alt weeklies, at least, were weekly.
Yes, and I was really glad for that.
Alt weekly. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. No, yeah. The idea of doubling my output was very daunting, and actually, you know, that 2-week schedule enabled me to tell more involved stories. Like, you know, they became over time quite long and dense. They filled the same space, but my writing got smaller and the panels got like more packed with details, but I could tell a pretty nuanced story in that space.
Yeah. So let me ask you maybe about some of your inspirations on when you get to the format of, so you've got a page and you've got 2, 4, 6, 8, you know, you got between 9 and sort of 15 panels on any page. I have to imagine that most of the examples you would have from your childhood are pretty much all 4-panel strips, right? You know, Sundays are longer, but pretty much it's like, you know, set up the gag, tell the gag, end the gag, right? Like, and so what was your beacon? What was your lodestone? Was there one?
You know, that's a good question. I wasn't trying to do a newspaper strip in the, you know, like the strips I'd grown up with. I wasn't doing Nancy or Dagwood. I wanted to tell complicated adult stories. I feel like I invented this structure to meet all these exigencies, you know, to fit the size of the paper and to all that stuff. But I was certainly looking at other, I was reading the Alt Weekly strips. I was reading Life in Hell, which is often just, you know, a few panels or even just one panel. And Linda Barry had that nice 4-panel grid. Some other artists, no, I can't remember. Was it Charles Burns who did Dog Boy or something?
Yep.
So I was looking at all of those, but I was doing something a little different. I feel like I was just kind of making it up as I went along, honestly.
Yeah. The closest comparison I would almost say, and it's really a terrible inexact comparison, would be something like Gasoline Alley, where you're following characters over time and they're aging and their situation changes over time.
Yeah.
You know, you follow Calvin and Hobbes every week, or every day, but Calvin never changes. Hobbes never changes. The situation never changes.
Yes. Yeah. I didn't really read Gasoline Alley growing up, so it wasn't influential in that sense, but I did like the way that it existed in real time. And I wanted to do that with my characters, have them all age.
Yeah. Did you pay attention to sort of like mainstream strips at that point, or?
Oh yeah. I read just all the newspaper strips.
Yeah. Okay.
I read the newspaper strips. I was going to the comic store and getting whatever was bearable at the comic store, like Discovering Love and Rockets.
Sure.
There wasn't wasn't a lot of that cool alternative stuff there in those stores yet. But
there was some early stuff. There was Tits and Clits. There was Women's Comics.
Yeah.
You know, 3 or 4 feminist kind of comics at the point.
That stuff was hugely influential. Actually, it was Gay Comics, which came out in 1980. And I just happened to stumble on it like the week I graduated from college. Someone just handed me this blueprint of what I would do with the rest of my life. Like,
yeah.
Oh my God, I can write comics about my queer life.
Yeah.
But Gay Comics was like a second wave, the second wave of the underground scene. You know, there was all the first wave with R. Crumb and all those guys. But then the women and the gay people started up their own magazines at the time that the other stuff was sort of dying down.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Gay Comics, Tits and Clits, all that stuff was my biggest, you know, inspirational fodder. That's the stuff that was really shaping what I was thinking about and writing about.
Sure. Because a lot of the undergrounds, I mean, you know, there's only so many jokes you can make or stories you can tell about getting really fucking high, you know, or, you know, pretty much being ultra violent or super sexual, you know, and it was the women's comics. It was the tits and clits. Even though there was a sexual element to them, obviously, but they were more political than anything else.
Yeah. And then there was also Weirdo. I loved Weirdo, in the '80s, which was a lot of wonderful R. Crumb stuff and a lot of, Aileen and R. Crumb's collaborations would show up in there, which I always loved.
And Raw as well. And so I guess I my next question would kind of be, why weren't you, or did you try to work for Weirdo, for Raw, for those other publications? Or were you just like, no, I really like my field. Okay.
It never occurred to me. It was like, it wasn't even a question in my head. I just knew what I was doing was not a fit, and they would just like reject me. So I didn't risk it. But you know what, Brian, another source of inspiration for me was American Splendor.
Yeah.
And Harvey Pekar actually reached out to me to illustrate some pieces once. And that was my big crossover moment. That was so amazing. It was Joyce's doing too. Joyce got in touch with me when I was gonna be coming to Cleveland, and we all had breakfast, and I did some work for Harvey, and that was just this amazing feeling like I was part of the Real Cartoonist gang.
I love that. Do you did you change any way that you approached comics working from somebody else's script, or
It was fun working from Harvey's script, not just because he, was such an excellent writer, but it was a relief for me at that point to not have to write and draw. It was kind of fun to just, all I have to do is make the pictures. That's awesome.
Yeah. Well, that's great. I'm sorry for like focusing so much on the old stuff. I'm fascinated by a lot of this, and a lot of this, sort of history has kind of gone away, and
I'm down with it. I don't feel like anyone's really that interested anymore, and I fear I'm going to lose my memories of it all. So this is good.
Yeah. Well, it's one of the reasons I want to talk about things like this, because I do think that people care. Actually, I think people care tremendously. They just don't know that they care yet. If you see what I mean.
Okay.
At what point did you start to make your living fully as a cartoonist? Was it after the first Dykes book was published?
It was definitely after that. I think it was even after the second book was published. Mm-hmm. Might have been between the second and third books that I finally quit my job at the newspaper.
Yeah.
And stepped out on my own.
Yeah, was
that 1990? I was 30 years old.
Yeah, was that scary? Was it liberating?
It was very scary. It was a tricky thing to do. Like I really didn't, have a cushion. Like, and I was at this point where I knew I suspected very strongly that I could do this. I could make my money just doing my own work, but I didn't have enough time to do the work because I still had this other job. So it was this very much this leap of faith that I had to take.
Absolutely.
Like, if I'm going to believe in myself, I'm going to quit the job and make it happen. And that was daunting to do, but I did it.
Yeah. So 1990, and when did Fun Home come out? 2006. Okay. So there's a 15, 16 year period in there before you went to become a full-fledged graphic novelist. What was that period like, I guess? Because it seems to me that a lot of the sources and the papers that you were working for were not sure things, right? There was a lot of uncertainty about the whole process. Am I wrong about that impression?
No. I mean, there were a few of those newspapers that were really solid and paid me well for all those years, but most of them were fly-by-nights. They'd start up, they'd fold, they wouldn't have money to pay me. So it was a very interesting period, that 15-year stretch. It was like an uphill and then a downhill trajectory. At first, there were more and more papers. There were more and more gay bookstores and more women's bookstores. And, as this community cohered, there was demand for my stuff, which was great. Mm-hmm. And I just kept doing a little better each year.
Mm-hmm.
And that was true until maybe the late 90s. And then it started slowly going the other way. And it was partly the internet, you know, having an impact on this whole scene. It was partly just gay and lesbian culture shifting, where people, there started to be some really fancy, glossy gay and lesbian magazines that, you know, weren't the kind of place where my comic strip would run. And so the culture was changing.
Was it more mainstreaming?
It was like, I'm thinking of Out magazine, which was kind of,
I was thinking the same thing. Yeah.
Like the gay version of Vanity Fair. And there was always a celebrity on the cover, and it was very, you know, it was a glossy.
Mm-hmm,
So as there, you know, we got this more kind of surface legitimacy, the ragtag edges started to drop off, and I was on that ragtag edge. You know, I began losing papers and losing income, and it was eventually even my small feminist press that published my books went bankrupt.
Yeah.
So it was around 1999, 2000 that I began working on this other side project, this memoir project about my dad. And I just kept working on that and kind of putting as much energy into that as I could while this other stuff was starting to crumble. And fortunately for me, it was a gamble that paid off. You know, it's just very lucky.
What did I want to ask?
I remember actually just before Fun Home came off the press, I lost my biggest gay and lesbian venue, which was Planet Out, this wonderful website that used to come out.
Travel website, right? Yeah.
It was just a general thing in the early days. Might have turned into a travel website. But it was funny that it was that so close. I often felt like I got rescued off the deck of a sinking ship by the helicopter of the graphic novel craze.
Yeah. Was it exciting though that things were becoming more mainstream, and so you weren't quite an outsider anymore, and yet you can't make a living? I don't know. I'm just trying to fathom sort of that period between one state and the other.
I was very bitter in that period, you know, because I wasn't making it at that point. You know, I was, you know, fading into the margins even more than I had been.
Sure.
And that was frustrating because I felt like my work was getting better. I felt like my work was really good. And actually, in fact, this brings us back to the Alt Weekly thing. I had started making some inroads into the Alt Weekly world, which showed me that straight people were willing to read this cartoon about a bunch of lesbians. And that was very exciting to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it was just ironic and sad that I just started at that point when the work was really getting out there and getting good, that it was becoming less feasible, you know?
Yeah. It's funny because, you know, this afternoon, just to prep for this, I sort of read all 1,000 pages that you've drawn in books. it was a lot to read, but Dykes is not, I mean, it's obviously, it is very gay content, but it's not, it seems so mainstream to me today. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not out there. It's not like pushing an agenda. It's very, it's what you see on television. It's what you see in the world everywhere.
Yeah. But just the fact that these people were out and, you know, not apologetic about who they were, just living their lives as a matter of course, that was just, that wouldn't fly for a long time. It started to be okay, but and I, you know, I lived through that. And in a way, the comic strip was about that cultural shift. The characters are always commenting on it and, you know, participating in it.
Sure. Well, for me, at least, I appreciate the pioneering nature of what you did, you know, because as I say, this, it seems so normal right now, you know? And I know that it was hard, you know?
Well, that's the thing of, I mean, I don't mean to be self-aggrandizing because I'm not really a pioneer. There are other people who really were pioneers of gay comics.
Understood.
But yeah, stuff that was once cutting edge looks very, very tame now.
Sure. And the thing I'll say is even though you weren't necessarily the first, you did it for 25 years, you know?
I did. I was persistent.
That is an amazing thing that you should be very, 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 very proud of. And you should, you know, sort of hold that in your heart as, you know, a wonderful achievement, you know?
Thank you, Brian.
Well, I wouldn't say it if I didn't think so. So you started working on, as you put it, the side project of this book about your dad, which ended up becoming Fun Home. How did the context for that work? I'm assuming you always sort of had it in your brain. It's going to be a complete book by itself. It's not going to be serialized somehow.
I didn't really have a clear idea about it. I knew for a long time that I wanted to tell this story. And in the early days, I thought I would do it as a book, as just text, you know. But as I was becoming a cartoonist, it just became clear that that's how I told stories now. So that's how I would do it. And of course, Mouse came out in those years that I was learning my trade, and I saw what he had done with this form, you know, told this kind of story no one ever thought you could do in comics. So that just, you know, tilted the whole pinball machine, and people started doing all kinds of amazing work. For me, it was also Howard Cruz's graphic novel Stuck Rubber Baby that he did in the mid-90s that really was a direct inspiration. I knew Howard and sort of went through that period with him as he was, you know, just doing that brutal, incredible amount of work that it took to, you know, illustrate 200, 300 pages of a book.
Yeah.
Eventually I felt like I wanted to try that myself.
Yeah. And, yeah. It was almost surprising at the time that Stuck Rubber Baby came out through DC Comics of all places.
I know.
I mean, it was through the Piranha imprint, but still, you know, what you think of as a very staid, very conservative, especially at that time, company, and they were willing to publish that kind of a memoir, I thought was pretty bold, you know?
It was.
What did you think your prospects for selling the book were? Were you thinking that you were going to try to go to a DC or a Fantagraphics?
Well, no, because, you know, at the time, by the time I really had like a proposal or enough of that book done to submit, it was 2003. Mm. And then the graphic novel juggernaut was well underway. And I thought of Pantheon, like that's where I was going to send it.
Mm-hmm,
Pantheon said no. But I also, you know, from my whole career up until that point, I had just been on my own. And around 2000, 2001, after my little publisher went bankrupt, I went out and got an agent. And I'm so indebted to my amazing agent for just having much more of a vision for what this book could be and what I could do with my work than I ever did. So she sold it to a big publisher.
Yeah, I mean, certainly agents for graphic novels were not unheard of at the time, but it was a pretty rare occasion, yes?
I didn't know. I just knew that my writer friends were saying, oh my God, you have to get an agent. You're crazy if you don't get an agent. Yeah. So I just did that. And, you know, everything was still kind of fluid. Like, Fun Home was the first graphic novel Houghton Mifflin bought. Everyone was just figuring it all out.
What kind of package did you put together for them to buy? I mean, was the manuscript complete as a comic?
I'll show it to you.
Oh, sure.
Let me show you a little show and tell.
Yeah.
See if I can find it. I just got this out the other day because I was so proud of it, and I was trying to I'm always trying to copy it for other book projects. Can I share my screen?
You can. Jordan, tell her what she needs to do.
At the very bottom, it says share.
At the very, very bottom of the screen, all the way on the bottom, there's a button that says share, and it looks sort of like a box with an arrow.
Or like a plus.
Got it.
A plus, yeah. And then it'll say, do you want to share a window or share your whole computer screen?
Okay. I'm going to share. I'll just share the entire screen and make it work.
That's fine.
If it lets me.
It will eventually, I'm sure. There it goes.
Can you see that?
I can.
This is, Gordon, I made a graphic.
Why don't you one shot that? Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
I made this kind of graphic synopsis of the book. So it was set up like a comic.
Mm-hmm.
And I did this super boiled down version of the story. I had done a lot of writing and drawing at this point. So yeah. I used that to lay it out. And I did a page for each of the chapters, like describing the theme and the action of that chapter.
Okay.
And it was really tight, and it actually helped me to think about the book and to think about how I was going to finish it.
Interesting. So it's almost like a chapter outline in its own comic. That is really cool, actually.
Yeah. And I bound it along the long edge, and so this is broken up. It was this centerfold that then became that image in the book of the boy on the bed.
Yep.
It was just this super tight little comic. It was like a little mini comic, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's really cool. That's super cool. And at that point, I'm assuming the script was pretty much 100% written at that point, or?
No. I can't remember exactly how much, but it was just kind of fragments. Like, I had bits of each chapter done. I didn't have the ending written. It was maybe half written.
Okay. And was any of it drawn? Was some of it drawn?
I had like a few pages of each chapter drawn, and that's what I drew on to put this thing together.
Interesting. And so you drew it not in order, then, is what I'm hearing, that you did some pages and then you
my agent had the idea of you should draw at least the beginning of each chapter so people can get into that before you leave them to the words alone.
I see.
So that's what I did.
And did you end up changing a lot of that since it was so early in the process, or?
Not really. This was, I had done a lot of work, and it didn't stray too much from this. I mean,
okay.
It got richer and denser, but nothing major changed, I would say.
Sure. My understanding is that you are, you know, absolutely writing first. Everything is the, you know, the writing your own script for yourself. Yes.
Yes. Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it's a funny way of writing. Do you want, can I share another image?
Please share everything you want to. We love seeing process because it's fascinating.
Okay. I pulled up this, sample of how I write. You see that? Okay. I can't tell what's,
it's if you want to maximize that window, it might be a little better.
I write in Illustrator, in Adobe Illustrator.
Interesting.
And so it is writing. I mean, I'm typing and I have this font made up of from my actual hand lettering.
Yeah.
But it's a visual kind of writing. Like I'm using panels, and I got my dialogue balloons, and I'm often bringing in sketches of things, you know, to see how stuff is looking. But often I'm just, you know, sitting here typing like this and making balloons and just playing around with this composition until I have till I have it written.
So you're almost doing verbal, not verbal, but word-based thumbnails, I suppose.
Yes. Yeah. And actually, you can see, often I'll write little descriptions of what the image is going to be. I guess I don't have any on this page, but we'll put an explanation there of what the image is going to be.
Yeah, yeah. Fascinating.
That's actually for the benefit of my editor. So okay. I can show this stuff to her and she can edit before I go to the work of making all the drawings.
Yeah. I mean, it almost seems fourth dimensional to me in terms of how you're thinking about the page or how you're thinking about.
I like that.
Right? Because you are working it out in space, obviously.
Yes.
And in time, but it's also, you haven't drawn a thing yet. I'm fascinated by this. This is amazing to me.
Yeah, I mean, and it's endlessly flexible. I don't have to worry about mistakes because I can just, you know, delete something. It's just gone. Yeah,
sure.
It's a very messy process, though. It just gets so much stuff on the page eventually that I can't even tell what I'm doing and I have to start deleting stuff. but that's what I do all day.
That's super neat. And so at what point do you start doing the art itself? And do you begin with thumbnails? Do you like thumbnail it all out first?
I don't. I mean, okay. Because I just start drawing. Like I'll print this page out and start doing sketches.
Nice.
We're going down into the abyss. Watch out. I can show you a little bit of here. Will this work if I show this keynote presentation? Can you see that?
Yep, 100%.
Like this is what a page looks like when it's all finished being written. Like I'm ready to start drawing. I'll print that out and start doing my research. This is a scene about a karate class. So I do all this visual research, all this stuff goes into it. I do a lot of posing for, you know, reference shots. And then I just start sketching. Rough pencil sketches, refining them a little bit with pen. Just working it all out.
That photograph step. What percentage of the panels would you say you're pre-staging, and what are you kind of just free drawing?
I don't do any free drawing.
Interesting. Okay.
I wish I did. I wish I were more, self-reliant in that way. But I'm always looking at some reference.
And was this true on the strip as well?
In the early days, it was not. In the early days, it was much looser. But the more I did it, the tighter it got, and the more layers of sketches and the more research I would do.
Yeah.
So then here's my pencil. When I get everything figured out and get everything tidied up and just boiled down to this pencil line.
Yeah.
And nice. There's the ink.
Nice. Nice. I like that. And you're drawing physically, right?
Yeah, I can't do that digital stuff. I mean, I work on the computer. I do a lot of cleanup in Photoshop, but I try to spend as little time as possible on there.
Well, it's fascinating because you're setting up the whole thing.
I know.
Yeah.
I spend so much time there writing. The last thing I want to do is draw on the computer.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense to me. I love your line work, and it's pretty obvious that it's pen and ink to me. I love it so much. Let me ask you a question about the physical boundaries of a page, because you know when I looked at your 1,000 pages all in one day, one thing I very much noticed was that Dykes is Banks is very rigid, right? Now, this is because of the nature of it being, you sort of have to put it into multiple places where you're not sure what they're going to do. But, like, you know, even on any given two-page spread, like, the panel side, the shapes of the lines are the same throughout the entire book. There's pretty much no variation page to page to page, if you see what I mean. Panels are chopped up, right? But each line is the same. Fun Home, you loosen that up quite a bit, you know, because you're not
a little bit.
Mother, it's much looser. And then here on Superhuman Strength, I mean, it's very loose. You're actually, I would say, for the first time, really using the comics page as a page on Superhuman Strength.
I'm glad to hear you say that, because I the page has sort of eluded me. You know, as a strip artist, I never had to think about the page, and I've had to learn as I go. And it's just, I don't read a lot of like mainstream comics which have like mind-blowing page layouts.
Sure.
I was reading Weirdo, where they did, it was like R. Crumb doing his little regular boxes. You know, so I didn't really learn about, you know, how to visually design a page, or let alone a spread, you know?
Yeah.
So I've just kind of been, you know, trying to teach myself as well as I can, but it's not something like I have an instinct for.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're certainly grasping it a lot better. I mean, there are certainly sections in here. I think particularly that scene where you're climbing up the mountain and then you've got to rush down, but the rush down is an inset panel and it really moves through time and space, right? Because comics are as much time as they are space, unlike many other media. And it seems to me that, you know, in strips, it's only about time in a way because of the rigidity of the panel. I don't know if I'm actually making any sense because I'm not a cartoonist.
I think that holds water. I mean, the space is given, so you can't do anything to push against it, really.
Yeah.
But I'm glad you saw that. It might have been more notable going through all the books in one day. But I, you know, this book, this Secret to Superhuman Strength, was so much about, you know, like the world, like the way the self relates to the world outside, that these pages where things would like burst off the page felt really critical. Like I needed to get the story to like push like out of the book.
Yeah.
Like just, and it was hard. Like it's really so much more complicated to design a bleed than to just do a regular grid page.
Sure. Sure. Well, when you made the switch from strips to graphic novels, did you have to learn sort of the language of the page turn? You know, that on this facing page, you have to have something that propels you, you know?
Yes. And it was actually very thrilling to me to learn that there were constraints. You know, when I first thought about, oh my God, how am I going to fill 200 pages? I can do anything, anywhere. I can't. That's overwhelming. But then I started learning all the rules, and the biggest rule was the page turn. What shows up at the top of the left hand page, and put all your surprises there. And once I had, you know, something to latch onto, then I was able to start filling those pages.
Yeah, yeah, fascinating. It's fascinating how it changes. Jordan keeps throwing up the question thing to me, tells me I have a question that we have to ask. So I'm going to ask that question, which is from Pudrigo, who's one of the best contributors here at the Graphic Novel Club. What are some opportunities and or challenges involved in being author and character in regards to your work and to your personal life? That's a big question.
That is a very metaphysical question.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, because I write about my own life and my own self, and it's weird. You know, I feel like I don't think I can be very coherent about this, but sometimes I worry that all I am is like these stories that I put out there. Like I don't really have any inherent existence of my own. I feel like I even have come to resemble my cartoon avatar. Like
okay.
I like all, maybe that's, maybe I'm just a cartoon. And it's weird too, having lots of people know intimate stuff about my life. Right. I think I often, this interview has been really fun because I haven't had to talk much about that stuff. We've just talked about comics and craft and the business.
Sure.
So I can relax. I don't have to talk about myself.
Sure, sure.
But I often feel like I'm performing some weird version of myself, you know, and I'm never quite getting it right.
Well, let me ask this question then to follow up on that. Do you find yourself sometimes an observer in your own life that you're like, oh, this'll be great for the next book?
Yes, I do. And that's, you know, not a great way to live because it means you're not really present.
Present.
I don't know. Like today, my partner went out to run some errands and she really wanted me to come with her. And I really wanted to go with her, but I had to answer these interviews for the Brazilian edition of The Essential Dykes. So I said, okay, I'll come, but I'll bring my computer. And while you're in Home Depot, I'll work on my interviews. So I'm always leading this like weird bifurcated existence.
Right. You enjoy, right? I mean, you do enjoy this, right?
So shut up, Allison.
Nah, you know, I wonder too, in terms of Dykes, I'm assuming that Dykes is not strictly autobiographical. Right? That it's...
No, not at all. That's fiction. Yeah.
Because you look very much like Mo. Yes. Parts of those things were things you experienced or friends that you knew and you sort of synthesized?
You know, I would occasionally lift specific things from my real life, but surprisingly, no. All those people were just versions of myself. I mean, they look different, but you know that I was able to write about them because I made them all kind of little spin-offs of me.
Yeah.
And yeah, I just made it all up. It's funny to me that some people really think that those women existed somewhere and I was just like dropping in to sketch them once a week or something.
Sure, sure. Sure. Like well, you know, one of the things that makes me think is there's a kind of a section, I want to say it's in Fun Home, where you talk about how you can't write fiction.
It's an are you my mother? I say something like, I can only make stuff up about things that have already happened.
Right, right. So it's an interesting, because you know, for 25 years you did make things up.
I did. So? You know, I did, but it also, writing that comic strip felt to me in many ways like a kind of journalism. Like I was really trying to make a picture of the culture and the things that were going on, the politics, the trends, you know, the issues people were talking about. Like I was trying to fit all that stuff in. So it was like, writing a newspaper article in a way.
Yeah. Okay. I guess that is different than writing about purely, I mean, no one's asking you to write Wonder Woman, I guess.
Well, you know, I remember one time I got invited to the San Francisco Book Festival, and when my plane got in too late for me to be on the gay and lesbian nonfiction panel, they put me on the gay and lesbian fiction panel. So, whatever, I'll take it.
Yeah. No, that sounds good. Let's see. We got one more question from the Q&A. Let us go. It's from Zoe, who is my manager at my store and who is so shy and doesn't want to come over on camera and ask themselves. So I will ask the question for them.
Zoe an armadillo?
What?
Is Zoe an armadillo?
Zoe is not an armadillo. No.
Oh, okay. I can't quite see
a little, a little bit of an armadillo. Okay.
It's a pangolin.
Oh, okay. So anyway, Zoe asks, while reading Superhuman Strength, I was really glad you seemed to avoid the traditional and rather boring weight loss, fat phobia that often feels intrinsic during discussions of exercise. That's
Thank you, Zoe.
Was that intentional? I was wondering where the question was. Was it intentional? And if so, was it difficult to keep out of your writing?
It wasn't difficult to keep it out. I did, though, struggle with wanting to talk about fat phobia and, you know, all the bizarre cultural attitudes toward our bodies that, you know, exercise inevitably gets caught up in. But I had a fat friend who I was consulting about some of this, and I was saying, is this offensive? Can I do this? And she said, yeah, don't do that. You don't have it quite right. Thank God. Thank God I had a sensitivity reader. But we, in talking with her, we agreed that, you know, it's a more powerful statement for a woman to write a book about exercise without ever mentioning weight or appearance than to take it on as a topic. So I was like, great. I'm just going to leave all that shit out because I don't care anyway, you know?
Yeah, no, that makes sense to me. You have a follow-up, Zoe? No.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Very good.
Let me ask you just a little tiny bit more about comics and your history of comics. In the books, you certainly talk about being exposed to Charles Adams and the Adams family. I see you reading Mad Magazine. I see you reading Richie Rich. Can you sort of talk about comics in your household? And the reason I particularly ask is because both of your parents were at least at one point teachers. So you're clearly very well read, and your parents were clearly very well read. And so I wonder about the cultural expectation of comics in your household.
That's a great question. My parents did not have any kind of negative attitude toward comics. Charles Atlas, I just wrote about Charles Atlas in this book, but Charles Adams was a huge influence because we got the New Yorker, and I would just, long before I could read, I would thumb through that magazine and just look and look and look at all those crazy cartoons, trying to figure out what the hell they was so funny about them, you know? So we had the New Yorker, we had Peanuts. There was like all these volumes of Peanuts that I think my dad bought. We had Bill Malden. We had lots of all kinds of comic books. And we just, you know, it's just, there was no echelon, you know, they were on the shelf with the other books.
But pretty traditionally in that period of American culture, I mean, comics were looked down upon. So can you attribute that to anything in particular on your parents' behalf? Probably not, but.
Well, I don't know. My dad was always kind of trying to be hip and cool. So it was through him, I think, that he got me my first subscription to Mad when I was like 8. Over my mother's objections. She didn't think I should have that stuff at that age, but he prevailed. I think he just thought it was cool, you know?
Yeah. Mad's a little much for an 8-year-old sometimes, depending on when you were reading Mad. I mean, that's a good thing, probably, but...
Yeah, it was the late 60s, early 70s was when I was really mainlining it, and that was, I think, the golden years.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, very culturally critical, you know, though very straight culture too, you know, and very sort of mainstream culture, but very critical of those things. It's kind of an interesting place.
Yeah. I mean, I love the movie parodies. To this day, there's so many movies I haven't actually seen, but I've read the Mad parody. So I feel like I've seen them.
Oh, I love that. I love that. Do you see the influence of Charles Adams and Mad in your own work?
I do. I mean, in a sort of philosophical sense, Adams, I see, like, Adams has just influenced everything that I do in the way that he navigated that space between the caption and the image. There's just always this ineffable gap or space where your brain would just stop. And that's always been so exciting to me, you know, knowing how to how to blend the words in the pictures, how to not over explain in the picture what you're saying in the words, and vice versa. He was just such a master of that. So I'm always trying to, you know, replicate that, that balance.
Yeah. I also see a fairly large amount of Will Elder in your stuff, just in terms of just the level of detail and the level of kind of noodly little detail, you know?
Yeah, he was a big influence. I had a lot of older Mad, you know, anthologies, and I just loved his stuff, all his bizarre little, you know, the bat, did he do the Batman?
Yeah.
Bat Boy, and yeah, I loved that one.
Yeah. And Starchy, the Archie one. Oh, yeah. Those really freaked me out when I was a kid. Both of those stories, because there was something really dirty about them, but there was nothing overt. You know, you couldn't like point to a panel and go, "Oh, look, there's something wrong here." But
yeah, no, the Batman one was, yeah, or the Super Duperman,
yeah,
with the way Lois Lane treated Superman. There's something very kinky about that.
Yeah. No, fascinating. So you, I mentioned this in email, and I don't know if you have a thought about this, but I had this thought that popped into my head in terms of Fun Home, and in terms of Fun Home becoming a Broadway musical, that you share that lineage with a very, 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 very small number of cartoonists, primarily Harold Gray and Al Capp, both of whom I would not say would even remotely share your politics or your point of view.
Who is Harold Gray? I don't even know.
Harold Gray is who did Little Orphan Annie.
Oh.
Right?
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, and then Al Capp why am I blanking now?
Little Abner.
Little Abner, yeah. Which was also, a giant musical on Broadway, you know. And
I never thought of that little grouping. That's very funny.
Yeah, it's a strange little group to be in, right?
Yeah.
Feels like it's a Jeopardy question.
It would be a very good Jeopardy question. yeah, what a strange thing that was. Well, I don't know. What about Edward Gorey? He had a Broadway show.
Was it a musical?
I don't know. I never saw Dracula.
Yeah, I don't think it was.
I think it's not.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's probably a couple other in that group. I know that there's at least
Jules
one more.
Jules Pfeiffer.
Pfeiffer, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. Hmm. But again, not musicals, you know.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know. Just struck me as a thing. I assume you didn't really read Little Abner or Little Orphan Annie.
No, yeah. Those weren't in my newspaper growing up.
Cool. One of the things that you talk about a lot, particularly in Mother, I think, is that you feel very competitive with other cartoonists and other people who are doing work in your space. And so I'm wondering, and push back if this is a question too far, I'm wondering if the raw success of Fun Home made doing Mother and doing Superhuman Strength harder, because your expectation was to beat your own self.
Yeah. Yes.
Is that a fair question?
That's a very fair question, and it's true. But at the same time, I do want to say that feeling of tremendous envy and competitiveness was before Fun Home came out, and that has been assuaged a great deal by the success I've had with Fun Home. I'm not quite as abject as I once was. That was in those days when I was like losing papers every day and didn't have enough money to buy my next graphic tablet.
Sure.
But still, yeah. So nobody tells you this, but if you're lucky enough to have a successful book, you have a really big challenge ahead of you. And the, Are You My Mother was a difficult, painful book for me to write in many ways, because I was, trying to top Fun Home and knowing I wasn't going to, and finally just deciding, okay, I'm just going to do this totally weird book and just do whatever I want. And it was just an arduous process, and it wasn't the book people were hoping it would be. You know, that's always painful too. Like, I do feel good about that book. It took me a while to come around to feeling good about it. Mm-hmm. But I now feel like it did get to become the book it was meant to be when I let go of trying to replicate Fun Home.
Yeah, I understand.
And with this newer book, I actually kind of just wanted to write a book that was fun for me, you know?
Yeah.
And I didn't have that same, I didn't feel the same pressure I had.
Yeah.
With Are You My Mother?
No, it very much comes across. I mean, there's a fluidity in Superhuman Strength that that feels very freeing to me, you know? Mother is a little straitjacketed, you know?
It's quite rigid, yeah. And very, it's all hewing to the reference photos I was taking. It's got this very camera-y feel.
Yeah. Yeah, but Superhuman Strength is—it has less of that. It feels much freer. It feels much looser. It feels like you're having fun with it, in a way that maybe you know, even Fun Home, it doesn't feel like you had fun doing that book necessarily. Right. is that fair? Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It felt like that, so I'm glad it comes through in the book.
Yeah. Yeah, I liked Superhuman Strength a lot. I mean, I really enjoyed this, and I thought that I thought it was really strong. I actually, you know what I want to ask you? I want to ask you about story structure, because the one thing, and I wouldn't have made this connection if I hadn't read all the books at once in an afternoon. But one of the narrative trick, I suppose, is that you're bringing in other stories of other authors, right? It's the romantics in this, et cetera. You know what I'm talking about. So is that, was that inherent to your original idea of what those books were? Was it added after the fact, or is it a tick, maybe, a writing tick?
I think it's partly a tick. It's partly very organic. Like, I didn't know going in where it was going to go or what writers might come into the mix, but I did want other writers to come into the mix. I feel like I'm not interested so much in my own particular story, even though I am very interested in my own story. I know other people probably aren't. So I like drawing on these other, you know, veins of material. It just feels rich and exciting to really learn a lot about some other person's experience and weave it into mine. It feels like it adds a dimension to the book. And so
it very much does. And there's kind of a friction between autobiography and biography, right? Because they're different things, and I think it there's a space in there that's really interesting.
In this book, I was really interested in not just these writers' personalities or what they wrote, but the actual arcs of their lives, mm-hmm. like how their lives went, you know. How did their creativity, you know, go up and down over the course of their lives? Because I was looking at those questions about my own life, like why does creativity come sometimes and not other times? And when do I know I'm doing the work I'm meant to do? And when am I on the wrong track? And so it was interesting to look at how that played out in these other creative people's lives.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. Have you ever given any thought to just doing a biography of someone or another without sort of the mixture between the two?
I don't think I would like that.
Okay.
I couldn't just submerge my own ego enough to do that.
I love that. We're getting close on our time limit here, though. I'm having a really good time, and I suspect you are too, right? Like, this is passing pretty fast.
This is really great, Ryan. Okay. Yeah.
Let me ask you a couple more. I got a couple more things I want to go through here. What did I want to ask, though? It was, actually, you know what I want to ask you, and I'm sure you've been asked this way too many times, but I want to ask you about the Bechdel test. And has that made your life harder that this thing is named for you, and that it seems to me like a lot of people misunderstand it too and use it for reasons that maybe aren't what you intended?
Yeah, it's like I've washed my hands of it. I mean, it's nice.
Okay.
I think the general principle of it is nice. It's about, you know, treating women as full human subjects in stories. Yeah. And that's a good thing to do. But it's just funny to have it attached to my name. It's not even my idea. I stole it from my friend. She stole it from Virginia Woolf.
Right.
It's just one of these cultural flotsam and jetsam things. And I'll take it.
Sure. Does it generate like a lot of questions from reporters? Is that like a thing you're always having to deal with?
I mean, I think less so now that I've kind of I never have anything interesting to say about it. I don't really apply it to movies. I don't have my own like Bechdel list. It's not my thing. So it doesn't really, hasn't been sticking to me in that way.
Love it. Okay. A craft question. Dykes obviously is full black and white. Fun Home is monochrome. Mother is more or less monochrome, but you're using different shades, and then Superhuman Strength is full color. Can you talk about maybe the progress and the process to do that? Was there a reason that you wanted this to be in full color rather than in tone?
Well, again, just like I wanted the drawings to kind of spill out of the book, I wanted the vividness of color. It's a book about exuberance and vitality, and it just seemed to demand color. But color is a shitload of work. I don't know how anyone works in full color, you know, like draws and colors their own work. I know lots of people do, but I didn't want to live on the computer doing all that coloring. That just seemed deadly to me.
Yeah.
I actually didn't even do it. My partner, Holly, did the color. If we have time, I can show you a little.
I have all the time that you have. You're the one who said that.
I do. I have to go to bed. It's like
2:30. No, I understand.
But let me just show this little. Okay, so here's my line art. I would print that out and do a little color, just a very minimal color sketch that I would show Holly. Holly's she is an artist and works in stained glass and paint, so she's, you know, knows her way around color. But oddly, she wasn't working with color. I had her do this all in gray ink wash. This is just a close up of our little codes that we had. But here she is. Here, let me make this bigger. She's coloring in the color with just the ink wash of varying intensities.
Yeah.
So each page that she finishes just looks like, I stuck this in. Basically, she's doing color separations. I'll show you, but
sure.
You know, it's like the old way that comics were done before
right.
the digital era. Right. So here's her cyan layer. Here's her magenta layer. Here's her yellow layer. And she would be figuring out, you know, what areas to color in on which layer. It was a hugely unpleasant, almost mathematical task. I would do one layer of shading. This is me coming in just so my hand was on each page.
Yeah.
And so then we'd turn those, that gray art into color in Photoshop. It would get tinted, and here the colors are all coming together.
Yeah.
I added a gray layer just for some richness, and there's my shading.
Yeah.
And here's
Jordan's like, that's incredible. I've never seen anything like that before. You know, I'm old enough that I know exactly what you're talking about. I have some original art over here on the walls that we have the color, the original color. And it's the same kind of thing. It's that layer. That process. It's a fascinating process.
Yeah. Actually. Yeah. I mean, when I never worked for any newspapers or anyone who had enough money to pay for color. So I never got to do that, but I knew how they would do it, you know, with layers of Zippitone and stuff. And it was just fascinating.
Yeah.
But I did this because it was a way of keeping some kind of measure of control over the color, even though someone else was doing it. And it turned out to be this really rich and luminous technique. I'm really happy with how it came out.
Yeah, no, it's really beautiful. It's really nice. And it's interesting to me that you're like sort of each chapter ends in black and white as well. Not fully, but particularly the end of the book is in black and white. It's kind of arresting in that sense. Well, that was an intentional decision, I'm assuming.
Yeah, I've always loved Soumier painting, and there's something about the spontaneity of it that's really exciting to me. Like, you can't fuck it up. You commit yourself to this page with this loaded brush and you make it happen. I wasn't doing really technically proper Soumier painting in those black and white scenes, but there was something, those were moments when I was trying to kind of lift the story out of the realm of the everyday, the sharply defined world that you see in all the other pages with the black and white, you know, the sharp black and white, the line art and the normal color. Here it's done with a brush, so it's very a different quality of line.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of like things sort of blending and merging together in the way that life kind of does.
Yeah.
On a certain level.
The other question I wanted to ask you about Superhuman Strength was it feels to me, and I don't know if this is true or not, but it feels to me that the end of the book is really recent. That
it came right up to the end
or something. Did it change from what you thought it was going to be? Because it almost feels like the last 8 or 12 pages are tonally different from. Like, it's almost to me like you didn't actually know what the secret was until you got to the end.
I didn't, but you know what happened was, I don't even know if I can explain this right. Like, you know, most of the book was all figured out, but I knew that it was going to end. I needed to bring it up as close to the present moment as I could. And the present moment was the fall of 2020.
Right.
And I was waiting to see what happened with the election.
Right.
The election happened. We still didn't know what was happening. I was inking and Holly was coloring. We had the television on for all those weeks. You know, it was like, where is anything going? You know, am I writing a book, you know, for the fascist authoritarian regime we're going to be living in? Or are we going to have like a last gasp of hope that this book is going to come out into? So all that stuff was shifting constantly and changing the writing. And I was also getting into the flow with the book. Like it was really toward the end. I'd been working all year really hard on all these drawings and all the billions of minute details of the book. And I was just like living in the book in this trance-like way. So I think some of that ecstasy is part of the ending of the book too. Like I really was in this altered state.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, it comes across very much so. And yeah, I wasn't sure how you were going to stick the landing. But I was really pleased with sort of that final message, about that. It's not something external from us, that the strength comes from with us and the world that we live in, and we have to live in the world and be part of the world.
Yeah.
you know, because so many things are about external validators, you know, and it's, you know, this is a really obvious thing to say, but, you know, the arc of your graphic novels have been, you know, analyzing how your father impacted you, analyzing how your mother impacted you, and now it feels like you've come to yourself in this book, if you know what I mean.
I like to think I have, Brian. Thank you.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely.
That's a good note to end on, I think.
Yeah. No, very much. I got one more question I want to ask as a personal question. So you did the zoom in there. You did the book plates for the book.
Oh yeah.
Right? And it's out of focus. There we go. There it's in focus. And so you hand drew these. You individually hand drew 400 book plates and toned them?
Yeah, that's just a marker. I did that with a marker, the shading, yeah.
That's insane. You're an insane person. Nothing. I love you. That's great, but
no,
wow.
That was fun. I mean, that was really fun. The really big chore I had was I had to actually do 5,000 of those for the publisher. Like, I don't know, they did some kind of special edition. 5,000. It took me like every night for weeks.
Wow.
To mass those up. Yeah.
Wow.
But you know, you can't just sign your name. That's bullshit.
Yeah. That's what most people do though. I mean, honest to God, you know, again, this is our 100th selection or something like that for the club. And everybody just signs a piece of paper. You know, you're the first
really?
Person that can draw individual. So that to me is superhuman strength. Honestly, Allison. So yeah, and if anybody's watching out there and they want a hand drawn copy, we have them for sale, and Jordan will put that. There's the link. You can buy them there, and we will sell them to you very, very happily. We always end the show. Well, there's two questions we end the show with. One is what's next? Do you have the next book figured out? Do you know what you're doing? Are you already working on it? Are you taking a break?
I'm working on the next book. I know it's going to be something to do with the topic of money.
Okay.
But I'm not sure what form that's going to take. It just seems like a very capacious and interesting topic.
Okay. Interesting. And no deadline for yourself yet, or?
I'm still working on the proposal, but hopefully it won't take 8 years like this one did.
Right.
I'd like to get it done a lot sooner.
Yeah. And then the last question I always like to ask is, there's a lot of people who watch this series who want to make comics, who want to do comics. They haven't quite figured it out in their heads. They don't quite know where to go. What's the piece of advice that you would give someone who wants a career in comics? And it doesn't have to be, you know, it can be philosophical, it can be craft-based, it can be anything you want. It can even be don't, you know, whatever it is.
I guess I would say find a reader, even if it's just one person. Maybe you'll find a group of readers. That would be great. But find people like not you who can look at your stuff and give you feedback, and you'll know if they like it. I think it's hard to work in a vacuum, and it's tempting to work in a vacuum because it's, you don't want to risk rejection or failure, but you have to get yourself out there. So find a way to find a reader who you feel safe with.
Sure. Especially when you're doing 200 pages at once.
Yeah.
Well, it has been an absolute pleasure, Allison. I'm really
Likewise.
Glad that we had this chance to talk. I really love the book. And I thoroughly recommend it to everybody who's watching at home.
Thank you so much, Brian.
Yeah, no, it's
a been great my question. Absolute. This was really fun.
Yeah, well, you know, it's what I do. I think about comics in a different way than you do, but I think about comics every day, and you know, I like talking about them too. Let me do a little bit of business here. You can go back to a one shot for me, Jordan, if you would. Next month's graphic novel, the Adult Graphic Novel Club, is going to be Dave McKean's Raptor. Dave McKean is a brilliant multimedia cartoonist. This is a beautiful, beautiful book. You're going to like this thing so much. It's giant, too. It's enormous. And then on Sunday, our Classics Club, we're interviewing Joe Hill and Gabriel Rodriguez for Lock and Key. Next month's Classic Club is going to be ElfQuest, and I've got Richard and Wendy Pinney here. And then our Kids Club this month, And this is a book that all of the adults here loved so much. The Dire Days of Willow Wheat Manor. Even though this is a kids club book, every adult should read this too, because it was hysterical and it was wise and it was a joy. So that's what we got coming up, the next couple shows. And but this show was for The Secret of Superhuman Strength. If you are looking for a book to read, you want something, you know, to teach you about how the world works. And I don't know. I thought it was smart. I thought it was funny. I thought it had a lot of energy. I loved it. And I love Alison Bechdel. Thank you so much for coming. Yeah.
Thank you, Brian.